You may begin your presentation.
Thank you and welcome, everyone. This is Jody Levin-Epstein of the Center for Law and Social Policy, CLASS. We help manage the initiative Spotlight on Poverty and Opportunity, the source for news, ideas, and action, the host of this audio conference call. If you don't already get Spotlight's weekly e-gram, which conveniently links you to the latest research news and commentary from thought leaders, it's easy to sign up. Just go to spotlightonpovertyandopportunity.org. You know, and be sure to send us your own reports and news so we can post those as well. Over 830 people registered for this audio conference. The subject of today's audio conference is poverty impact projections. The idea behind a PIP is that it gives a clearer picture of how a policy or a set of policies might impact poverty. Environmental or health impact projections already help inform those fields. One way to use a poverty impact projection is to attach it to pending legislation. A legislature could decide that as certain kinds of bills move forward, a PIP should be undertaken so that policymakers would know that if a bill passed, poverty could be reduced by 12% or 8% or 22%. In the U.S. Congress, Representative Barbara Lee has introduced national legislation that would provide such insights for federal bills. No state yet has a law on the books that requires pending legislation to include a PIP, but there has been a bunch of legislative activity. For example, California passed a measure a few years back that then-Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed. And in Louisiana, much more recently, a bill was introduced, and there the sponsors now working to accomplish the task administratively. We will hear today about Colorado's effort. Pending legislation, though, isn't the only time a PIP can be helpful. A group of any kind may want to prioritize recommendations, and a PIP can help it sort through the choices or the sequencing. A number of states with poverty commissions have contracted to have a PIP undertaken. Often the motivation, though, is to better appreciate the degree to which policies actually would help meet the state's target to reduce poverty, a target like cutting poverty in half in a decade. We will hear today about Minnesota's effort. This kind of forecasting is relatively new in the U.S., but in the global context, not so much. CLASS issue brief on PIPs covers these and other issues, and you can find the link right in the list of resources for this audio conference. The purpose of today's audio conference is to explore why there is a growing interest in PIPs, and it's a chance to learn a bit about how a poverty impact projection can get done. We will hear today about that from the Urban Institute. In the spotlight today with me are Linda Gianarelli of the Urban Institute, John Kafalis, representative from the state of Colorado in the state legislature, Brian Rushi of the Minnesota Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. Hi to each of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Before I start asking each of you some questions, we want to make sure that the audience knows that they should be emailing questions to me as they occur. So it's a simple address. Just send your questions to me at audioconference@clasp.org. And I want to thank folks who are already sending in those questions. Keep them coming. Also, I want to make sure everybody knows that you will, as a registrant, get an email from us which links you to the tape, the posted tape of this audio conference call that you can then circulate to everybody in your office or your networks. But what it really means is you don't need to take notes. You'll have both a tape and a transcript. So questions first up for you, Linda.
Good afternoon.
Hey. You have undertaken PIPs in some states. Let's zero in on the story of Connecticut. First, who asked for the analysis?
Our analysis for Connecticut was done under contract with Connecticut's Child Poverty and Prevention Council. That's an organization or a group that they started in, I believe it was 2005, and their goal was to cut child poverty in half over 10 years, so a very ambitious goal.
And so exactly what were you asked to assess?
Sure. By the summer of 2008, the council had developed a list of policy ideas, a pretty wide-ranging list. They realized that some of them might be conducive to quantitative estimates, to trying to put some numbers on how much those ideas might reduce child poverty. So they contracted with the Urban Institute to assess a subset of their policy ideas. The ones they asked us to look at included guaranteed child care subsidies, expanded education and training, higher participation rates in government safety net programs like food stamps and housing subsidies, and some enhancements to the TANF program.
So let's sort of zip to the end here. What was the conclusion of the analysis?
When we combined all the policies that we were asked to estimate, the result we got was that the child poverty rate would fall from about 10.9% to 4.9%. So that was a drop of over half. And one of the single big elements in that was expanded housing subsidies. If we took out the expanded housing subsidies, then child poverty dropped by about a third. And by the way, all those estimates are using an expanded definition of poverty that I think we'll talk about a little bit later.
Definitely. We need to drill down into that. So can you fill us in? And this is a really challenging one because, you know, you're a researcher and you have that whole vocabulary, but can you tell for a lay audience the basic steps of how you go about doing the analysis so everybody could have a flavor for what's the scope of the work and how it's done?
Sure. In concept, it's truly pretty straightforward. So what we're doing is we're starting from a big survey data file. We know that the government does surveys of the country with people in, including families from across the country. So we start with a big survey data file that has thousands of families from the state that we are looking at. One by one, we look at those households with a computer program. The computer program looks at those households. It adds up the families' resources as they are now without the policy, and we compare those resources to the poverty threshold, or sometimes called the poverty line. If their resources right now are below that number, that poverty threshold, then they're poor. We call that the baseline. We do that for all the families. Then we impose the policy. Let's say the policy is that more eligible families are going to take the food stamps that they're eligible for. So that family might go from having no food stamps in the baseline to having a few $100 worth of food stamps every month under the policy. So their resources would go up by a few $100. That might be enough to bring them from below that poverty line to above it. Obviously, some policies are more complicated. For instance, a policy that liberalizes or expands tax credits, which we've done under some other projects, might bring some additional people into the labor force. So it might have some other impacts beyond just a simple dollar change in resources in a particular month. But that's basically it. We impose the policy change in our survey data, and we see how many families go from being poor to being non-poor.
That's a really helpful primer. Linda, and you were mentioning, and I agreed we'd need to drill down into this very complicated issue again about a simple question. The simple question is the measure of poverty that gets used, because it makes all the difference in determining whether or not a proposal increases or decreases poverty. The measure is really central. There's been a lot of conversation about alternative measures being used because the official poverty measure is agreed to be outmoded. So can you explain to us, again, in an overview kind of way, why an alternative measure is what you all use?
Sure. I think I alluded to this earlier, that estimating if a family is in poverty has two pieces. First, you have to add up their resources. Then you compare those resources to the poverty threshold or the poverty line. The official poverty definition has a really simple definition of resources. It's cash income. So a change in food stamps may be similar to cash, but they're not cash. They're not counted as cash by the official measure. A tax credit can have a big impact on a family's resources, but that's not counted as cash income in the official measure. So those kinds of policy changes and other kinds of policy changes aren't picked up at all by the official measure. So for the kinds of work where we're trying to assess the impact of multiple kinds of policy changes, we really have to use an expanded measure of poverty that has an expanded measure of what a family's economic resources are. The other piece is the threshold. The threshold that's used in the official poverty measure is outdated, and it doesn't take into account variations in costs across the country. So all of our poverty work over the past quite a few years has used an expanded measure of poverty, similar to what the Census Bureau is now working on and calling the supplemental poverty measure.
So the official measure has its limitations. The federal government is developing this supplemental poverty measure and will be releasing a preliminary version of it. And you've used something like it in your expanded measure. At the same time, while it's a vast improvement, these alternative measures also have their limitations. Can you drill down a little bit for us so we understand those limitations as well?
Sure. No single measure of poverty is a perfect or comprehensive measure. For instance, even though the supplemental poverty measure, or we'll call it the SPM for short, even though the SPM uses an expanded definition of resources, there are some policy changes that even an SPM wouldn't pick up those impacts. A change in child care policies that created an improvement in the quality of a family's child care, even if the cost of that child care was unchanged, that would certainly be a really positive thing for those kids and for that family, but that's not going to be picked up in an SPM measure. So that's just one kind of limitation.
Linda, we're going to have to race us through some questions because the number of questions coming in is wonderful from the audience, and I really want to get to those. But let me ask you, you've been in other places, and you've done this kind of work elsewhere. Could you just give us an illustration of where you've been rather quickly and maybe some of the findings?
Sure. For Center for American Progress, or CAP, this was back around 2007, we estimated the impacts of some policy changes at the national level, and their package of policies reduced poverty by about one quarter. That was overall, not just for kids. For Minnesota's Poverty Commission, we did a project very similar to Connecticut. We're currently working with Community Advocates Public Policy Institute and in Wisconsin, and also with the Heartland Alliance in Illinois to test different packages of policy changes in those two states. So those are some top examples.
And here's a chance to be more like a commercial. If someone from a state wants to have Urban do an analysis, how can they find out more about how to go about doing that?
We'd be very happy to talk to anyone who wants to think through these options. They could contact me or Sheila Zedleski or Laura Wheaton.
Super. And can you also then be Macy's talking about gimbals and tell about what some colleague organizations that are also working in this area trying to help groups develop PIPs?
Sure. There's fabulous work going on. The first place I should mention is Institute for Research on Poverty, which has really done some groundbreaking work, and they've developed a measure for Wisconsin. They have a whole website. If you just Google Institute for Research on Poverty, you can get down to a website that talks a great deal about all these issues, about the expanded poverty measure, and it's a really good resource and has links to a lot of the different work that's going on. New York State and New York City, actually a lot of this a lot of groundbreaking work was done by the New York City CEO doing a poverty measure specifically for New York City along the same sort of SPM line. And again, if you go to their website, you'll find really useful information.
Linda, I've gotten two questions from two audience participants that's identical. And they're asking if a PIP has been used on the local level, undertaken at the local level. And in answering that question, can you also weave in the particular data challenge at the state level? So they're asking about local, and by local, mm-hmm. I think they mean city or county.
Mm-hmm.
I want you also, though, to talk about the challenge at the state level.
Sure. New York City, I guess one would qualify that as local, although it is a pretty huge locality. But that was that work has been done specifically for the city, not the state as a whole. When you talk about the data challenges, in order to be confident about the results that you're getting from this kind of analysis, you have to have enough families from that place in the survey. And for that reason, when people are looking at a particular state or New York City, the survey that people have been using is the American Community Survey, which is a relatively new survey compared to some of the other government surveys. The American Community Survey, or the ACS, has just really huge sample sizes, or you know, surveys huge numbers of families, about 10 times more than the survey that's used for the official national poverty measure. So when you have that really big number of families to work with, you can be more confident about the results that you're getting. Even with the ACS, there may not be enough families from a particular locality, particularly if it's a smaller place. So that would really be a specific question that, you know, would have to be thought about, you know, given the exact place that someone wanted to do that for, what their options would be.
A lot of our listeners have specific policies that they have in mind, and they'd like you to answer the poverty impact in their state right away on the phone, I'm sure. But I'm going to ask one of those questions as illustrative of the kinds of things that different kinds of policies people may be thinking about. If you could just sort of help us quickly get a feel for the kinds of ways to approach those questions that might be undertaken in a PIP. And so here's the illustration. If the government mandated principal reductions in mortgages for underwater homeowners, what would the impact be on poverty projections for the next 1 to 10 years? Clearly, you can't answer that question right now, but how would you, as the PIP researcher, approach that?
Sure, that's a good question, and thank you for knowing that I can't answer that on the phone. Thinking about that question, what would be the anti-poverty impact of reducing principal on mortgages, you'd first have to think about how many families are in that situation who are currently in poverty. Obviously, that's the maximum number of families who could be helped. And then of those families, how many would actually be helped by the policy? Is this something that would be available to everyone, available only to some people in certain circumstances? So that would further reduce the maximum number of families who could be helped. And then you would have to think about, well, what's the change in their mortgage that would result, and you could think about that as a kind of increase to their family resources. You'd also have to think about some broader issues that wouldn't, you know, automatically be picked up as a resource change. At a broader level, a policy that might let a family sell their house could have other benefits. For instance, maybe they could move to a place with more job opportunities if they were able to sell their house. So this kind of policy would, th- th- there's no automatic model already set up that would automatically answer that question comprehensively. You'd really have to think through the different pieces and make some assumptions at each step.
Time for one last question here, Linda. There are folks sitting out there who are in underfunded organizations.
Mm-hmm.
What's a state or community group to do if they have little or no money to contract for this sophisticated analysis? What are some steps they can take?
Sure. If the organization does have access to survey data and someone on staff who has some experience using survey data, that there are certain things that they can do, that they can look at the characteristics of families in their state or locality, and without a great deal of sophistication, look at the kinds of families who are currently benefiting from the policy that they might want to change, and make some rough estimates of how many families could be helped by their policy change. There's also a lot of information available on the Census Bureau's website, including some information on poverty at the state and local level. So I guess I would say that there are some things that an organization can certainly do on their own, and they can certainly look at what's been done by IRP, by the Urban Institute, to maybe get some ideas about where they could do a sort of simpler version of something.
Terrific. Thank you so much. Representative Kafalas, before
yes,
you got engaged, hi, before you got working on poverty impact, you sponsored and secured legislation to create a poverty task force in Colorado. Why did you think Colorado needed a task force?
Yes, thank you, Jody. Good morning, everyone. Well, I was elected to the Colorado State House in 2006, and one of the first things that I did was create or establish a what we call the Common Good Caucus, which was an attempt to bring together legislators in a bipartisan way to talk about these issues and raise awareness. I quickly determined that having a more formalized and concerted effort would be valuable, and so in 2009, I ran a bill, House Bill 09-1064, which set up the Economic Opportunity Poverty Reduction Task Force. Basically, this is a 5-year, 10-member bipartisan legislative task force, and our basic charge is to look at public policies and practices, as well as private sector best practices that promote economic opportunity and reduce poverty. So that was the idea, that it was important to have something formalized in state law to help us reframe the public discourse around poverty, to move it away from being a partisan issue to more of a nonpartisan issue, and looking at it through the lens of economic development and collaboration and so on.
So what's your favorite accomplishment so far of the task force?
My favorite accomplishment, well, in 2009, the first year we were set up, we were an official interim committee, and we basically introduced 8 pieces of legislation that came out of the committee and also came out of the community, because that's one thing that was important, is to make this process very inclusive and include folks in the community. But we passed 8 bills, and many of those bills were bipartisan, and they were meaningful, and ultimately they are contributing to improving people's lives. So that would be the biggest thing.
That's great. I'm sure there are a lot of jealous legislators around the country who wish they could point to that kind of success, especially the bipartisan part. So, John, let's get right down, though, to your bill around poverty impact projections, which would have been attached to legislation. Why did you introduce that kind of a bill? What was it that grabbed you about the idea of poverty impact projections?
Sure. Thanks, Jody. Well, first of all, the bill that you're referring to was a bill that I ran in this last legislative session, 2011, and that bill, for those who are interested, is House Bill 11-1078. And basically what the reason I ran this bill is because I felt we needed to have better tools for evaluating public policy, especially public policy proposals that have to do with children and families. And so having something like the idea of the bill was to establish these poverty impact statements that could be requested by certain members of the legislature if indeed the there was a potential impact on child, individual, or family poverty, and then to include information either qualitative or quantitative to provide information to legislators and the public about the impact of this proposed legislation.
And so would you, in your bill, have applied it to all pending legislation? Was it going to be something that had to attach to everything that got introduced in the legislature?
No, not at all, because for one thing, that would be very costly. I mean, and actually I had some amendments to the legislation that would have actually set this up sort of as a pilot. But the idea was that not everyone in the legislature could request a, quote, poverty impact statement, but that the chair of a committee of reference, for example, the one committee that I'm on is the Health and Environment Committee, a chair or a ranking member could request of legislative council staff such a statement. And again, it had to do with the potential impact on child, individual, or family poverty. And some of the criteria or areas of interest that we put into the legislation, issues relating to household income, assets and financial security, work and income support such as child care, et cetera, food assistance. So if the bill had to do with those kinds of issues, then somebody could request this poverty impact statement.
And who would have done the analysis? Did you identify in the bill who was tasked with doing the work of the analysis?
Yes. Well, in this particular legislation, our nonpartisan legislative council staff would have done the analysis. In Colorado, I don't know how it is in other states, but every piece of legislation that is introduced must have what we call a fiscal note to determine if there's any fiscal impact to the public, to taxpayers. And what I was trying to do was, where appropriate, where relevant, include a narrative regarding the poverty impact projections or poverty impact statements. So Ledge Council would be the entity to do this analysis.
So John, the bill did not become law, so what's your next step in this arena?
Well, my next step is to bring back the legislation. There's a couple of things, but fundamentally I plan to bring back this legislation in the upcoming session in 2012, new and improved, and I would welcome anyone's input, ideas for how we can do that. I have some ideas myself. So to bring back the bill would be one next step, but also working with folks like Linda and others, the Institute for Research on Poverty, to bring the capacity to do supplemental poverty measures in Colorado. And that's something that I've been working on with our legislative council staff, our economists, and our fiscal analysts. And I think we're getting closer, and I think that's going to be critical. If we have those tools, then it'll be easier to do these kinds of poverty impact statements.
This is a reminder to the audience. You've been great. You're sending in your questions. For those of you who've forgotten the address, it's simple. It's audioconference@class.org. Shoot away those ideas and questions, and we'll get a chance to ask them. John, Colorado legislated a target to reduce poverty. Could you just briefly tell us what the target is and whether or not you think having it has mattered in any way?
Yes, of course. Indeed, the legislation that set up the task force, there was also a specific target, poverty reduction target, and that is to cut child and family poverty in half by 2019. So that's the target. As far as does it matter, and the short answer, of course, is yes, it does matter, because it provides a focus, it provides a goal that that we can all strive towards, and I think it creates a lot of incentive and motivation to stay with this thing, because I think folks listening understand the complexities of what we are trying to do here. But I think it's also important for people to understand that if we do the right policies and execute them properly, we actually can make a difference. And that's one of the things that I learned at this conference that Linda referred to earlier. There are policies that we're doing, whether it's expanding the earned income tax credit or other kinds of things, that actually are helping keep kids out of poverty and address this issue.
We have a question here from the audience about what type of members were on your task force and how was community input solicited? And if you could speak to that, particularly with respect to interest in poverty impacts and projections, if it's possible to do so.
Sure. Thank you for the question. The members of the task force, it's a 10-member task force, and it's made up of legislators. And the way it's set up is five are Republicans, five are Democrats, and they are appointed by leadership. I chaired the task force the first 2 years, and then we switched the chair. And right now there is a Democrat in the Senate who is the chair and a Republican in the House who is the vice chair. So that's the basic body. But what's really important for people to understand is we engage the community by setting up a variety of committees or work groups around different topics. And that allowed for opportunities, for folks to do the yeoman's work, in the community to come up with ideas. And then that would inform the legislators, and ultimately that would inform public policy. So it was very intentional from the get-go to try to do this in a very inclusive way, looking at all the sectors. And another thing that's really important, and I'll stop there, is really important to try to engage the business community, because they are critical stakeholders or players in the solutions to this to this complex issue.
John, the last question.
Yep.
Here is what's being asked. Your advice. Your advice, given that you're a state legislator, regarding tips for both other policymakers and for advocates.
Well,
what's your message?
Sure. I think the most important thing is to make it clear to fellow legislators that one of the values of doing poverty impact projections or statements is that it allows us, especially in these tough financial times, to better evaluate, what it is we're doing and how we're using taxpayer dollars. So if we can reframe this, if we can use those tools to help us see how this is indeed an economic development issue, to help us see how ultimately I think we can save taxpayer dollars, I think that's important advice for legislators. And for the community folks, to continue to push us to engage them in a collaborative process for really addressing these issues. And we just have a moral imperative to do that as well as a fiscal imperative, because we have to do things differently.
Thank you very much. Brian, I'm going to get to you, but first I want to throw back a question at Linda. Linda, we have an interesting framing question about the research.
Mm-hmm.
From a university school of medicine.
Okay.
And the question is, how does this approach you described to the PIP evaluation reflect the model used by the Wider Opportunity for Economic Self-Sufficiency? What's the difference between doing a PIP and using the Family Economic Self-Sufficiency Standard that a lot of people around the country have heard about that was developed by WOW?
That's a really great question. I think there's two differences. One difference is that the poverty thresholds, even the SPM poverty thresholds, are going to be different from the Family Self-Sufficiency Standards. And one isn't better than the other. They're trying to measure different things. Even the SPM poverty thresholds are trying to establish a very low income level where you have the purchasing power about one-third of the way up the economic ladder, whereas a family self-sufficiency amount is maybe a higher amount. At what point are you fully self-sufficient? Do you no longer need any government assistance? So that's one difference. The other difference is that when people are looking at the self-sufficiency amounts, they're typically thinking about one family. Would a certain change help, you know, one family with a certain number of kids, et cetera, be able to be self-sufficient? Whereas what these poverty impact statements are trying to do, or the kind of research that we've done is trying to do, is say, if you look at the whole population in the state, how is that going to change the poverty rate? So I'd say those are the two differences.
Thank you very much. Brian Rushi, you're on.
Hi, Jody.
Hi. And you're with, just to remind the audience, the Minnesota Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. So the first question for you, in a state which has both a poverty impact projection that was undertaken by the Urban Institute and a bill on TIPS was introduced, could you just tell us, Poe, about what the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition is and why you all are involved in this stuff?
Yeah, we're an interfaith social justice coalition made up of religious leaders and clergy and lay people, and we're sponsored by the largest faith groups in Minnesota, the Catholic Conference, which would be the Catholic bishops, the Minnesota Council of Churches, which are the mainline Protestants, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota. So Catholics, Protestants, Jews, and Muslims have formed this public policy coalition to work on matters where we have agreement. And each of the faith groups reserve the right to speak differently about unique issues and places where there's not agreement, but we all agree that poverty, as John said earlier, it's a moral imperative to make sure that every person in Minnesota has their basic needs met, and that it's a societal responsibility both through public and through private initiatives to make sure that we end poverty in Minnesota. So we put forth this rather audacious goal that we wanted to end poverty in Minnesota by 2020. The clock is ticking. As you mentioned, we had a poverty commission, and one of the things that we worked on was this poverty impact statement. So the religious community played a big role, but all kinds of nonprofit agencies, also some business leaders, some public officials, some education leaders, a lot of people came together to support this movement. So, you know, it's an interfaith social justice organization.
Great. Well, terrific. Now, you and I had a conversation where I got an aha. It wasn't very long ago, and you told me that the PIP that Urban did for Minnesota was useful in community organizing around poverty and opportunity. So can you share with everybody what you shared with me, because it really was an aha. How is it that the PIP feeds into community organizing?
Well, I think poverty is one of those topics where, at least when I'm working with groups and people are wanting to do something, we have to get over a psychological barrier, or just a barrier about possibilities. Because I think most people who don't think a lot about this feel that poverty is intractable, that public initiatives largely haven't worked. There's all kinds of messages out there that just put people into what I would call a paralysis. It's too big. We don't know how to approach it, and I just don't feel very much hope about this issue. That's kind of the starting point with a lot of groups. And so to be able to say to these groups, look, we've done some very careful, quantifiable analysis, and the Urban Institute did this kind of modeling for Minnesota in the context of our Poverty Commission's deliberations. So we have a Poverty Commission report now that shows what would be the impact in very linear fashion. What would be the impact if we were to increase the minimum wage, increase the earned income tax credits, fully fund child care, put more effort into the take-up rate for SNAP benefits, put more education and training opportunities in place, we can say to people, look, if you get on these policy levers, we can reduce poverty by, and in this case, the model showed that if you do those five those five things to scale, we would reduce poverty in Minnesota by 27%. Now, there's something about saying that out loud to a group of people that gives them so much hope and kind of cuts through all the garbage and gives them, you know, kind of a clear path. Okay, you know, we're on a third of the problem just by doing these policy levers. The other thing was that the modeling showed how some of the policies work together. Their synergy. So, like, in terms of prioritizing, well, what do we do next? It's important to look at things like the child care funding and the earned income tax credits and the minimum wage. I mean, those things work together powerfully. I mean, John alluded to this earlier. Some impacts would cause more people to go into the labor market. Okay, well, this kind of model tells you that. You get more than the sum of the parts. So in terms of giving hope, in terms of giving a roadmap, it got people a lot more excited than I think they otherwise would be, just because the information was an antidote, if you will, to the paralysis. I hope that's what I said earlier to you.
It is, exactly, and I'm feeling the aha all over again.
Okay.
So, Brian, you were all very fortunate in Minnesota that the Urban Institute came out and did this analysis for you, and then as well, there was a bill that was introduced to require that a PIP be done for certain pieces of legislation.
Right.
This idea a function of your state poverty task force work and recommendations itself?
It was. It came up fairly early on in the Poverty Commission's deliberations. I think some citizens actually brought it forward and had either borrowed from maybe John's work or other states. I'm not
actually,
sure.
We borrowed from your work.
Oh, okay. Well, you're welcome.
Yeah, sure. I guess we didn't ask. Sorry about that.
No, we want this to spread. The only thing that I would point out that was a little different about ours was that, well, I guess there were two things. We allowed any chair or ranking member of any committee to ask for one, because we really didn't want to limit it just to the typical traditional human services committees. Or the jobs committees. We really wanted people in transportation and education and the health department and other, you know, committees of jurisdiction to also think. And, you know, one of the wild examples somebody gave was, well, maybe the transportation people should be thinking about what would the effect of bus fare increases be, or bicycle lanes, making it easier for people to get to work without a car. They don't spend money on gas or a car. So those kinds of out-of-the-box thoughts, we wanted to make sure were at least possible subjects for a poverty impact statement. The other thing that I think was a little different is we, in our stat or our bill, said that we wanted the poverty measure to be the National Academy of Science, the new measure of poverty. And so we may have to go back and do some work in that area about whether that's been refined a bit more. And then the other thing was that we used our state demographer as a place to house this this analysis. And the state demographer was actually kind of anxious to do this work. And I think the way to think about it is that the state demographer would sort of be the quarterback in terms of getting information from various agency personnel to do the work. So it was a bill. It is, you know, I think we'll talk about it in a minute. We weren't able to pass it through, but
So speak to that, Brian. Why not? Why couldn't you get it through?
Yeah, we just had a terrible budget deficit in Minnesota. The last two budget cycles, our expected income was way below our expected expenditures, and so there was just this almost blanket policy across the committees that they just wouldn't think about anything that cost new dollars. And this does represent some work and some tasks that state employees and legislative staff would have to do, and we didn't have a way to pay for it. So, you know, we didn't want to be defeated before we even started. We then began some discussions with our University of Minnesota here about some possible ways of doing some resource sharing. Maybe some joint fundraising from the charitable sector, from our foundations, about trying to find some way to make this happen. Now, we haven't resolved that yet, but we're trying to think creatively about maybe bringing in some academic horsepower along with existing legislative staff and the State Demographer's Office to make this happen. But quite frankly, the budget situation swamped us. And I think we also have to take responsibility as a coalition with our colleagues that we just aren't big and powerful enough, and that kind of gets back to the organizing piece. So we're going to continue to, you know, meet with groups across the state and organize around this idea that we should do everything that we can aimed at ending poverty by 2020, and one of the most helpful things we could do is have this analysis inside state government.
We're going to need to begin to wrap up, but I want to, Brian, ask you a question we've gotten here as to whether or not the PIP analysis and the scope for PIPs in Minnesota that you thought about in the bill or will be thinking about might go beyond education and training policies and focus on some economic development sector, job creation, impact issues. That's speak to that, please.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we hope and our vision is that this would be a very wide-ranging opportunity for everyone in state government to begin thinking, you know, just to have that discipline of thinking about what would this policy change do to the poverty rate. And I think every example we've had on the audio conference so far has been how do we get on this lever to decrease poverty. Quite frankly, there's some things that we're thinking about doing in Minnesota that will increase poverty. We're seeing some attacks on some of our public benefit eligibility standards, for example. Well, it would be so helpful if we had agreed upon numbers in terms of how many more families would be in poverty if we make this change. So, and it's not just the public benefit programs. It would be like the questioner said, what about jobs and training programs? What about wage subsidies or tax credits? I mean, I think there's all kinds of things in the tax committee that ought to be subject to this kind of analysis. How we treat property tax refund programs, for example. Anyway, wide-ranging is our vision.
So in closing, I'm going to ask each of you to answer good idea, bad idea to a proposal just submitted by one of our listeners. The proposal is, has anyone thought about using the White House's We the People website to petition the president to suggest using PIPs with policy at the federal level? Good idea or bad idea? Linda?
I guess a good idea.
Great. This is just good idea or bad idea. John?
Good idea.
And Brian?
Yeah, it sounds like a good idea.
Well, awesome. And I want to thank everyone in the audience for joining us today. We challenged our speakers and ourselves to do a very short audio conference, 45 minutes, lots of material to get in a very short period of time. If you go to the resource at the forefront, Poverty Impact Projections, it provides you links related to the subjects that we've talked about here from the Urban Institute, Minnesota, and Colorado. I want to thank very much for being in the spotlight today, Linda Gianarelli of the Urban Institute, Representative John Kafalas from the State Legislature in Colorado, and Brian Rushi with Minnesota's Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. Thank you so much to everybody. Thank you, Linda, John, and Brian.
Thank you.
Good luck.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Work.
Everyone have a great day, and we will send you an email with all the links you need. Thank you so very much, everybody. Have a great day.
Good weekend.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.